was aglow with whirling, transient nodes of thought careening through a cosmic vapor of invention.
Welcome to Chain Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we transmit a sexy, high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I wanted to dedicate this first show of the new millennium to one of the technologies that I think is really going to rock our world in the coming millennium, and that's nanotechnology. Now, nanotechnology is a hypothetical fabrication technology in which objects are designed and built with individual specification and placement of each separate atom. The first unequivocal nanofabrication experiments took place in 1990. This is from a definition of nanotechnology that's out there on the web. For example, with the deposition of individual xenon atoms on a nickel substrate to spell IBM. Now, the big impetus for nanotechnology came with K. Eric Drexler's book, The Engines of Creation, in which he predicted that nanotechnology could give rise to replicating assemblers, permitting an exponential growth of productivity and personal wealth. I've already interviewed two folks on this show who address nanotechnology, and one was David Berube. Interviewed him about 6 months ago. He's a futurist in South Carolina who has penned an essay on nano-socialism. You can find it if you type that word into the web search engine. And his article on nanosocialism argued three things: that nanotechnology, which I'll elaborate more on in a second, that it will destroy capitalism, and that the economic impacts of full nanotechnology will make it unprofitable for any firm to bring the technology to full fruition, and therefore that it will require federal R&D or government support for this technology. And third, he argues that the ecological and military threats from nanotechnology are so dire that they necessitate strong global regulation. And I'm going to touch on all of these points. Now, the second person I've interviewed on this show about nanotechnology is Ralph Merkel. He was until recently, he was at Xerox PARC, and he has become now the leading consultant to a nanotech startup firm called Zyvex. And Zyvex is dedicated to creating the key technology to what's considered true molecular nanotechnology. That is, to have a robot which could actually put together atoms into molecules. And that sounds pretty far-fetched, but Zyvex.com is out there. You can check it out on the web. And Merkel is out there, Merkel.com. And another key site for nanotechnology is Foresight.org, which is Eric Drexler's home. And I want to read a little bit from Merkel's description of nanotechnology, because I think it will illuminate this a little bit better. Manufactured products are made from atoms. The properties of those products depend on how those atoms are arranged. If we rearrange the atoms in coal, we can make diamond. If we rearrange the atoms in sand and add a few other trace elements, we can make computer chips. If we rearrange the atoms in dirt, water, and air, we can make potatoes. In the future, nanotechnology will help us snap together the fundamental building blocks of nature easily, inexpensively, and in almost any arrangement that we desire. This will be essential if we continue the revolution in computer hardware beyond about the next decade, and will also let us fabricate an entire new generation of products that are cleaner, stronger, lighter, and more precise. So nanotechnology should allow us to get essentially every atom in the right place, make almost any structure consistent with the laws of physics and chemistry that we specify in atomic detail, and have manufacturing costs not greatly exceed the cost of the required raw materials and energy. So, in other words, positional assembly and self-replication. And he goes on to talk about the need to create molecular robotics, that is, robotic devices that are molecular both in their size and their precision. These molecular-scale positional devices are likely to resemble very small versions of their everyday macroscopic counterparts. Another key element of the vision of nanotechnology is that these have to be self-replicating. These manufacturing subsystems, these micro-robots, these nanobots, have to be self-replicating, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to have enough of them to make enough of anything. So they have to be able to reproduce. Now, the science of getting stuff really, really small is proceeding apace. And I want to read just a couple articles here, and I'm going to tune up another tune. I think Brian Eno is more appropriate for the millennium. Ah, yes, Brian Eno. A little bit of calm. This is an article that came out in Science a couple weeks ago, and it is an example of our steps towards self-replicating programmable molecular-level robotics. It was an article from Dr. Philip Kim and Charles Lieber of UC Berkeley and Harvard on their fabrication of nano-tweezers. The tweezers are capable of picking up objects just 500 nanometers, that is a billionth of a meter across. The tweezers are made from two carbon nanotubes, which are tough, tiny cylinders of carbon atoms, which are just 4 microns, or millionths of a meter long, and 50 nanometers in diameter. The carbon tubes were attached to gold electrodes on either side of a glass rod, and by applying a voltage to the device to exploit the electrical properties of the tubes, they were able to make the arms open and close, just like the arms on a normal pair of tweezers. The team has used the tool to manipulate clusters of plastic beads, which measured about 500 nanometers across. The tweezers could have been made smaller, but the researchers wanted to demonstrate the principle at a size that could be picked up by an optical microscope. Now, another article in Science recently reports that buckytubes, which is what I just was talking about, can be used to detect toxic gases such as nitrogen dioxide and ammonia. The scientists hope their discovery will lead to a new generation of tiny environmental sensors. Both nitrogen dioxide and ammonia contribute to greenhouse warming and acid rain, so levels in the atmosphere must be constantly monitored. Engineers also need to measure concentrations of these gases at, for instance, coal-burning plants to check the efficiency of scrubbing systems that remove pollutants. So the team found that the flow of electric current through carbon nanotubes increases when they're exposed to nitrogen dioxide and decreases in response to ammonia. The researchers are not sure what causes the change, but Professor Dai says a likely explanation is that the gas molecules are donating or removing electrons and so forth. Now, here's another one. Another story again from Science. Reports that Cornell University physicists have shed new light on chemical bonding by combining a single molecule with a single atom to form a new molecule. Professor Wilson Ho used a specially designed scanning tunneling microscope, or STM, to pick up single molecules of carbon monoxide and graft them onto an iron atom to form molecules of iron carbonyl. By obtaining the new assembly's vibrational spectrum, a measure of the energy in the bonds between the atoms, they verified that a chemical bond had truly been formed to produce a new molecule. Lee noted that the technology used could have future applications in nanofabrication, the creation of materials and devices at the atomic or molecular level. One implication, he said, is that since we can build up molecules from atoms step by step, in the future it might be possible to build up more complicated molecules from separate ingredients. So this idea of the universal assembler is you have a box of universal assemblers, and you put in your compost or your garbage or a tin can or something, and you program it somehow, you communicate with it somehow, and you say, make me a block of gold. And out the other end or out of the bottom or somehow, a block of gold gets created by taking apart the atoms of the thing that you put in and recreating it into some new substance. That's the ultimate vision, the universal assembler vision. Now, a lot of technologies are moving in the direction of getting small enough to do those things. And one of the things, key things that we would have to do is to be able to have microelectronics, to have computing be that small. So again, researchers at Rice reporting in Science have announced, for instance, this is in the November 19th issue of Science, the creation of a molecular computer switch with the ability to be turned on and off repeatedly. Such a switch or logic gate is a necessary computing component used to represent ones and zeros. The switch works by applying a voltage to a 30 nanometer wide self-assembled array of the molecules, allowing current to flow in only one direction within the device. The current only flows at a particular voltage, and if that voltage is increased or decreased, it turns off again, making the switch reversible. So again, this is a molecular level logic switch or computer component. The difference in the amount of current that flows in the on-off state is known as the peak-to-valley ratio, that is, and it is currently 1,000 to 1. The typical silicon device response is at best 50 to 1. The dramatic response from on to off when the voltage is applied indicates the increased reliability of the signal. Okay, and finally, this is an article from the November 2nd New York Times, And it reports on the progress towards molecular-level computing. Hewlett-Packard scientists say they have recently taken an important step towards creating rows of conductive wires that are less than a dozen atoms across, a crucial part of hooking together the molecular-sized switches that could one day result in computers vastly faster than today's models. Other laboratories working under top-secret conditions are making progress on a number of fronts. One of these labs is said to be working on a molecular device capable of holding random access memory, or RAM. Today's silicon-based microelectric devices have a minimum size between electrical components of 0.18 micron, or 1,000th the thickness of a human hair, but they could potentially go as small as 0.1 micron. That would be 100 billionths of a meter, or 100 nanometers. But in molecular electronics, the smallest components may be able to shrink to 1/100th that size, a single nanometer. The difference would mean chips exponentially more powerful than anything of a comparable size today, or computing devices unimaginably tiny by contemporary standards. The recent rapid pace of advance has led to a palpable sense of mission among a small group of physicists, chemists, and computer designers who until recently were viewed as impractical dreamers by much of the computer industry. Again, that's from the New York Times of November 2nd. And it goes on to describe the tremendous amount of money that's being poured into research and the impact, potential economic impacts that it will have on the computer industry when their multi-billion dollar chip factories, fabrication plants, are made irrelevant by molecular computing. And apparently the Clinton administration is now considering the possibility of a national nanotechnology initiative as early as this spring to set up financing and help organize diverse research activities in nanotechnology. Now, one of the goals of nanotechnology is not just to make stuff out there, but to help us to transform our bodies and the possibilities of our lives. And one of the key things that people are looking forward to with nanotechnology is to release swarms of nanobots in our bodies to track down errant genes and pathogens, bacteria, viruses, and so forth, and repair the aging process in a continuous and ongoing way, to have a kind of second layer of defense on top of our immune system. One of the things that we would have to do with these nanobots is not only have then the computing power and the manipulation abilities of the micro tweezers and so forth in these nanobots that are much, much smaller than human cells, but also have a tremendous amount of knowledge in those nanobots about the nature of the human body and an ability to sequence and identify the things that they come in contact with. So, for instance, research now being done on biochips is feeding into that. And here's an article from November 21st, New York Times. Biochips look like the integrated circuits in a personal computer, but instead of containing tiny semiconductors, they are loaded with bits of actual DNA that make up genes or fragments of genes. Inserted in a PC-sized analytical instrument, the chips allow scientists, and this is about current technology that's actually being used, the chips allow scientists to perform thousands of biochemical experiments at a fraction of the cost and time required for traditional tests. Biochips, or microarrays as they're also known, will bring genomics, the study of all genes in a living organism, out of the research lab and into the daily practice of medicine. If genomics delivers on its promise, healthcare will shift from a focus on detection and the treatment to a process of prediction and prevention. Fortunes will be made. The initial market for biochips has been in drug discovery, and the major customers have been the large drug companies. By analyzing the subtle changes in genes when a cell becomes cancerous or is infiltrated by a virus, scientists at these companies search for new molecular targets for drugs. This needle in a haystack process could take many years using test tubes and petri dishes, but is accelerated a thousandfold by biochip technology. Of course, the biochips use the basic ideas of of semiconductor manufacturing, that is to have tiny channels carved into silicon in a chip, and then they put fluids through those channels instead of electricity, and allowing those fluids to be analyzed in ways that then are read off electronically back into a computer to tell the computer what exactly is happening with the tissue or material that it's being exposed to. Now, the convergence you know, obviously one of the things that's going on is that there's the existing nanotechnology of medicine and of white blood cells and germs and viruses, of viral agents which are being used for different purposes, which is going to converge with the nanotechnology goals and technologies. The convergence seems very, very likely. And so we have to ask the question, once we have self-replicating nanobots with a tremendous amount of computer-based information downloaded into them, hopefully controllable by the people who created them, how much are we going to be able to keep these things in control? We're going to have billions of them in our bodies or in industrial processes, self-replicating. And with our current biological technologies, we have the problem of genetic drift and mutation. We don't usually think of our PCs spontaneously evolving into killer machines, but nanobots will be a lot closer to biological organisms. Just like our kudzu, our staph, our strep, our cockroaches adapt to everything we use to control them and roll on, what is the guarantee that we can control our nanoviral tech? One of the classic science fiction novels exploring nanotech is Greg Bear's Blood Music, and it's about a nano researcher who injects himself with self-aware robots, self-aware nanobots, who first dissolve his body and then dissolve the entire world and all of humanity. This scenario is called now in nanotech circles the Grey Goo Scenario. One organization devoted to discussion of the Grey Goo Scenario is the World Transhumanist Association, and that you can find them at www.transhumanism.com. Now, this is a quote of the raison d'etre of the WTA. The WTA was founded in 1998 with the aim of turning transhumanism into a mainstream academic discipline. The WTA seeks to promote research into the science and philosophy of the future, to encourage reasoned debate, and to facilitate the exchange of ideas between researchers on all transhumanist themes. We work to increase public awareness of the benefits, but also the risks of the technologies by which humanity will seek to overcome its biological limitations. Now, this is a definition of gray goo from the transhumanist FAQ at the WTA's website. And by the way, I have often described and describe on my website this show as a radical democratic transhumanist show, because I share much of the concerns and enthusiasms of the transhumanist organization. And I'll probably read the entire transhumanist manifesto or declaration at some point in the show. At any rate, Grey Goo from the transhumanist.org, self-replicating nanomachines accidentally get out of control and consume the whole biosphere, turning it into grey goo. Since molecular nanotechnology will open up new chemical reaction pathways, there is no reason to suppose that the ecological balances that limit the growth of organic self-replicators would pose an obstacle to nano-replicators. In principle, it would be relatively easy to build in multiple safeguards that would make it impossible for this scenario to happen. For example, one could make the self-replicating machines dependent on some vitamin, a rare chemical that they need to function. Or one could make adaptive mutations arbitrarily unlikely through the right kind of design. Experiments with self-replicators could be confined to sealed labs, small chambers that automatically explode, evaporating their content if anything attempts to penetrate their walls, either from the inside or from the outside. Consequently, provided the development of nanotechnology is done by responsible people and with stringent safeguards, the gray goo scenario could be avoided. So according to the transhumanist FAQ, there's just two problems: ensuring that all nanotechnology applications are subject to nuclear self-destruction in some kind of fail-safe way, and ensuring that all applications are used by, quote, responsible people. Which brings us to the transhumanist.org's black goo scenario. The consensus is that black goo is a much bigger problem, referring to deliberately manufactured destructive nanomachines. One way of meeting the threat of black goo is to develop active shields, automated defense systems with built-in constraints to limit or prevent their offensive use. One can imagine a global immune system consisting of nanomachines roaming the surface of the Earth in search of dangerous replicators. A problem with this approach is that even though it may be ultimately possible to build a reliable global immune system, it might be much more difficult to do so than to build destructive nanomachines. If so, there will be a time interval during which the world would be unprotected. It is essential that anti-proliferation treaties and global regulation prevent aggressors from abusing nanotechnology during that period. This is David Berube's point. Another way to reduce the risk of extinction would be to create distributed space colonies. That's very, very encouraging. Again, the problem is that it would take too long before this becomes possible on a large scale. How long the critical period is from the development of dangerous nanomachines to the development of adequate defenses depends on the rate of technological progress during this period. And by the way, you can check out a novel called Bloom by Will McCarthy, who is a physicist, who extrapolates what would happen if Grey Goo took over Earth and there were colonies out in space whose sole purpose and their everyday existence was threatened by little bits of nanotechnology flinging themselves out towards Mars and Jupiter, towards the space colonies. They were constantly, in this novel, examining themselves for infection and eliminating infection with great expeditious means. Now, finally, there's blue goo, the term for police nanobots intended to prevent gray goo, denature hazardous waste, destroy pollution, put ozone back into the stratosphere, prevent halitosis, and promote truth, justice, and the American way. Of course, our medical bots, our medical nanobots, are one example of blue goo. Now, on the web at www.erinet.com/prass/nanowars and so forth, you can find a web page called Nanotechnology and Science Fiction. There's many, many, many science fiction and nonfiction books out there inspired by the various goo scenarios and the use of nanotechnology in industrial processes and medical processes. For instance, cryonics folks and Ralph Merkel, for instance, talked on my show about the potential medical applications for folks who freeze themselves with medical nanobots, because, of course, when you freeze yourself, you burst the cell linings of most of the cells in your body, and most specifically the cells in your brain, your neurons. You would need a couple trillion nanobots in your brain to slowly go around and sew up all of the burst cells after you defrosted yourself, in order to be able to function after being defrosted. So many, many applications. Now, in recent news about goo, I just wanted to throw this out. A bacteria-infested yellow gel that eats through concrete could soon help engineers clean up radioactive contamination in the Sellafield nuclear reprocessing plant in Cumbria. The bacterium Theobacillus theoxidans is one of the culprits behind corrosion in concrete buildings and bridges. It feeds on sulfur-containing compounds in the concrete and converts them into dilute sulfuric acid, which eats away at any concrete it meets. Now, researchers at British Nuclear Fuels and the Idaho Nuclear Engineering and Environmental Laboratory in Idaho Falls have found a way to use T-theoxidans to dissolve concrete floors and walls contaminated with radionuclides. Humidifiers are used to keep the humidity level around the gel at 95%, which allows T-theoxidans to thrive and continue churning out acid. But when the engineers decide that they have removed enough concrete, the gel is allowed to dry out. The remains of the gel and rubble infested with the nucleides can be collected, sealed in concrete, and stored at disposal sites along with other radioactive waste. Here's another superbug. Reporting in Science, teams at the Institute for Genomic Research in Rockville, Maryland, and the Department of Energy said they had sequenced the genome, the entire collection of genes, of Deinococcus radiodurans. They say it seems to have thousands of unique genes that help it clean up the damage done to its DNA by radiation, helping it to survive where other creatures would die. Found happily living 40 years ago in a can of food that had been irradiated to kill germs, D. radiodurans has intrigued scientists ever since. It can survive 1.5 million rads of gamma irradiation, a dose 3,000 times the amount that would kill a human. It also pops back to life after being dried out and can live through high doses of ultraviolet radiation. Just last year, researchers genetically engineered it to eat up toxic chemicals such as toluene and mercury. A secret to Deinococcus's toughness seems to be a large number of genes that allow it not to prevent damage from radiation, heat, and other assaults, but to repair that damage quickly and efficiently enough to allow it to survive. Radiation, heat, and chemicals create breaks in the double helix of DNA that makes up the genes, and this can kill a cell outright. or cause it to make mistakes as it replicates, mistakes that can kill it or cause cancer and other disease. This organism transports damaged nucleotides out of the cell, which potentially prevents their reincorporation into the gene. Now, Michael Daly of the Uniformed Services University at Health Sciences in Bethesda, Maryland, has reported this week in Nature Biotechnology that he has engineered D. Enococcus radiodurans to eat toxic mercury compounds commonly found at nuclear weapons production sites and excrete them in less harmful forms. The scientist said the development shows how bacteria can be customized to attack the heavy metals, radioactive wastes, and other substances that pollute the soil and groundwater at nuclear sites. Now, you put this together with the announcement last week that scientists had determined the fewest number of genes that were necessary, which was about 300 genes, were necessary for an organism to self-reproduce. They haven't completely determined the purpose of all the different genes in the organism that they were studying. They were knocking out different genes and seeing how few they could get it down to. But basically, if you're able to create an artificial organism, which is what they had done by knocking out these different genes, they got down to an organism that had never existed or that we had never found, which was the smallest component of self-reproducing life, and you're able to put into that organism, say, for instance, radiodurans' abilities to self-repair, and to put into it molecular-level computing information, and to put into it micro-tweezers, and to put into it some ability to communicate in an array with computing outside of the can that you have them in, then you have nanotechnology. And so we're getting pretty close. The possibilities are getting very close. Now, one last thing I want to throw out there, some of the military technology applications. Researchers at the University of California at Berkeley are building a minuscule robot guaranteed to give new meaning to the old phrase, fly on the wall. Known affectionately as a RoboFly, the gadget is exactly what its name implies, a flying robot about the size of a housefly. It even looks a bit like a fly, although it will have four wings instead of two and one glassy eye instead of two beady ones. Uncle Sam, who's bankrolling the project to the tune of $2.5 million, and wants to see RoboFly airborne in 2004, it will add the flying robot to its espionage toy box. The potential application of a robot based on a fly might be in an urban environment, clandestine surveillance and reconnaissance. Flies, for all their faults, are outstanding pilots. They can take off and land in any direction, even upside down. They can change course in just 30 thousandths of a second, and they process information at speeds that make a supercomputer look like an abacus. RoboFly will weigh just 43 milligrams, roughly the weight of a fat housefly. Its body will be made of paper-thin stainless steel, and its wings of mylar, which looks and feels a lot like saran wrap. RoboFly will be powered by the sun, and a tiny device called a piezoelectric actuator will flap its four puny wings 180 times a second. The pint-sized, or in the case of RoboLobster, quart-sized, robots also represent a move among engineers and researchers towards micro-robotics. The idea is to use a bunch of little robots to do the work of one big robot or human. The Defense Department likes the idea of sending robo-beasts to do things far too dangerous for humans. Nasty little tasks like clearing landmines or inspecting nuclear reactors and submarines. Those aren't the nastiest tasks that I can think of when it comes to the Defense Department. At any rate, we've been talking about nanotechnology. Check back with us next week for more news of the future. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. If you want to learn more about radical democratic posthumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about the show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Also check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com. Check back next week, the same time, for Change Surfer Radio.